Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to MidRack, where the Navy MilBlog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Just a reminder, for those that are joining us live, please make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the page with the usual suspects. If you have some questions or observations you want to share as the show goes forward, Eagle One or myself will be in the chat room. We'll try to grab those and fold those into the conversation as we go. Also, if you're new to MidRats or you want to catch up on the shows you've missed, you can always reach the archives at Blog Talk Radio, the show page you can find linked on both of our homepages. Or if you're like me, you can go ahead and set up to get your iTunes podcast. And if you are one of our listeners who do listen or get the show via the iTunes podcast, if you could take a couple minutes, go and give us a review. Reviews are good. They can help raise the profile of the show some. And the only two reviews we have on there were really from the beginning of the show. And since we've upgraded the audio, we've pretty much taken care of most of the technical difficulties that one of the reviewers at least pointed out. Now let's get on with the show. Our guest for the full hour will be John Patch, Commander, United States Navy, retired. He is the Associate Professor of Strategic Intelligence at the U.S. Army's War College's Center for Strategic Leadership up in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. John, welcome to MidRats.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're going to hit a whole bunch of subjects today, but just for a minute, because we have a predominantly maritime crowd here, if you could tell us what the Army War College, a Center for Strategic Leadership, does, and what's your role there, and what are some of the major issues y'all are trying to address?
Well, the Center of Strategic Leadership is one of the three or four institutions on post in Carlisle Barracks under the Army U.S. Army War College. We essentially provide a forum for strategic leadership. It's very, very frequently utilized by Chief of Army Staff and other four-stars to bring their staffs up to get away from Washington, essentially, and conduct kind of strategic forum on things like where's the Army going to be in 5 years, 10 years, and things like that. The other big thing we do is at the end of the full year-long curriculum that the students have at the Army War College over Root Hall, they have a two-week war game. It's called the Strategic Decision-Making Exercise. We put together a five geographic crises around the globe, and we throw the students into different student cells, such as, you know, a bunch of students will act as the joint staff, another group will act as Department of Homeland Security, and then we have small groups act as the combatant commanders. We have some Title X groups, you know, Army, Navy, et cetera, for force providers. And we essentially give them those conundrums and make them, require them to make decisions. And we throw into that mix things like actual congressmen. We have sudden VTCs that pop up with, you know, the president asking that combatant commander, what's he doing about this problem? And we throw them into as real environment as we can to try to solve these crises. We focus on things like coalition building, the proper use of joint forces, things like executing con plans and O plans, and sometimes it's things like twists, like, for example, when there's not enough resources, they may, for example, have to fight over a carrier strike group, or maybe there's not enough strat air for them to achieve what they want, et cetera. So we try to give them the whole mix of real world so that then when they get out to their strategic positions at the joint staff or combatant commander higher, that they can be somewhat prepared for handling those big decisions. And I write the intel for that two-week exercise. So as a former Navy intel guy, I put a layered environment of threat based in 2025, and we try to extrapolate based on current threat environment right now to show an environment that's relatively credible and realistic, but it's all unclassified, too, so it's a bit of a challenge. We also have 50 international officers in the mix, so that always makes it interesting as well.
As one of the Navy guys on staff there at an Army War College, and we've been joint in a variety of ways for a long time, I think especially since 2001, everybody really has been soaked in it as a matter of necessity. But do you ever see a common theme from our other services, areas about the Navy or our capabilities that they express the most interest in?
Generally speaking, they're very focused on land warfare. I would say about 10 to 20% of the student body is non-Army, things like obviously Marine Corps, Navy, Coast Guard, some defense civilians and others. There is, with the Army guys, the land-focused guys, there is a tendency for them to just assume, and this is not a slam on them, this is just a reality of where they've been and where they're coming from, you know, up to a battalion command and higher, and a little bit higher than that. They just assume that the Navy will be there doing its thing, taking care of business, sort of peripherally in the background that they don't have to worry about. So sometimes, for example, the Navy staff over at Root Hall and myself, I try to get involved in that. We sort of try to round out the curriculum by showing them the strategic importance of sea power, you know, getting the beans and bullets to theater, protecting those sea lines of communication, things like theater, you know, theater ballistic missile defense, things like that, other things that the Navy brings to the fight that they really, as land power guys, they really just don't think about. They just assume that we have a handle on it and the Navy's taking care of all that and they don't really want to worry about it. Big problem with that is when it comes down to budgets and priorities, they also tend to take, as land power guys, they tend to sometimes take the same view, and that is, let's put all the money over on the land power and don't worry about that Navy stuff. So sometimes we got to remind them about the critical importance of sea power, not just as an enabler to land power, but as a key member of the joint force. You know, they do understand, for example, carrier air strike, power projection from the carrier, giving them that air power, you know, 24/7 as they need it. They understand that. But the rest of it, all those other missions, you know, strategic deterrence, nuclear, you know, ballistic missile submarines constantly on patrol, et cetera, sometimes we have to bring that into the curriculum to remind them that we're out there.
When you get into that discussion with them, are they surprised by the length of time it takes to conduct strategic sea lift of their assets to a theater? I mean, for Desert Storm and other operations, it's taken us months to get to prepare the logistics battlefield. Are they stunned by that?
I don't think they're stunned by it so much as they're usually stunned by the price tag associated with it. You know, they understand that about 90% of the gear is going to get to theater by sea lift, and they know the critical importance of Merchant Marine and of the, you know, Maersk liners and the other agreements we have with some of the merchant lines to get the gear in theater. But they usually have sticker shock when they see what the price tag is, because, I mean, you got to pay for that year in and year out. A good example of that is the afloat prepositioning that the Army has essentially depleted. It's no secret that they used to have a very significant amount of prepositioned brigade combat team sets around the globe. And with Iraq and Iran, with the constant fight and the constant, you know, burning through the equipment, those are essentially gone. There's some ships left, but they don't have the gear left. Marine Corps, on the other hand, has done a very good job of keeping three robust, viable, roughly regimental combat team sets ready to go, so that, you know, you can fly the Marines to theater and meet that prepo and have a viable MAGTAF ready to go on pretty short order, and it's, you know, sustainable with I believe it's 30 days of sustainment in organic air, et cetera, artillery that essentially the Army doesn't have anymore. So that's a big change from the past, I think.
Yeah, speaking of the Marines, put a post out about a year and a half ago where you got to give credit to the Marine Corps is they saw the upcoming budget battle and they really started to weigh in when we had the practical example of Haiti and the importance of sea lift and being able to in a quasi non-permissive environment, getting supplies ashore, the importance of being able to do that. But they've really been pushing the messaging, getting ready for the budget battles that are going to come down. Very obvious how heavy that's going to be. We also saw with the Debt Reduction Commission, when you look at some of the recommendations that are coming down, it looks like a perfect storm coming at the Marines in their mission. People want to cut the MV-22. They're always going after the EF, the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle. There's talk about narrowing down again the F-35 and the Marine Corps version of that. And you also have kind of self-inflicted wounds. We've created our newest amphibious ship, the LPD-17, which is too Tiffany and too expensive to get close to shore, so now we're telling the Marines, dump your Marines at 25 miles out and good luck at it, that the Marines, it seems, in the next few years are going to have an exceptionally challenging time telling that story and getting the funding to justify the ability to project power from the sea. Do you see that narrative successfully being discussed, or are they in significant danger in the next few years of just being looking at a way to access money?
Well, I think it's basically a little bit of both, and that may not be a very satisfying answer, but you know, traditionally the Marine Corps has done an excellent job on the Hill, representing itself and representing its missions. You know, when the Marines, the liaison officers are in there in their dress uniforms, dealing with Congress, many of these congressmen and senators were previous Marines themselves. They've done an excellent job showing the Congress what the Marine Corps does, what bang they get for the buck, and have been relatively well funded. But I think the phenomenon is, right now, it's changing dramatically. There are so few actual congressmen that have served, even fewer, because if you look at the whole spectrum, you know, the Marine Corps is always that small minority that understand it. So I think the Marine Corps is having a much tougher time trying to sell themselves on the Hill. I mean, even when you have the Secretary of Defense making comments about, you know, raising, you know, sort of philosophical questions about why we need to do amphibious assaults anymore. I mean, they're under the gun to sell themselves. I think they'll be okay with it, because traditionally they always have been so. In my humble opinion, and again, my views are my own and not those of the Army War College or the DOD or the Department of the Army, my humble personal view is the Navy is the big problem for the Marine Corps. They fall under the Department of the Navy. The Navy has quite a lot of say over that budget money. And when it's, is it, do we build that new amphibious ship, or do we give them 38, you know, amphibious ships for their lift, or is 33 going to be good enough? Those overarching decisions are going to be made by Navy guys. You know, certainly there's the influence of Marine Corps in the decision making, but the Navy, I don't know, is necessarily convinced that they need to be doing amphibious warfare. So unfortunately, the Marine Corps got to convince not just the Congress and the President of the value of the Corps and the equipment they need, but they got to convince the Navy to get up there and fight for them. And that's problematic. I mean, as I'm sure you've seen, it's how many amphibs do we need to have sufficient lift around the globe? And is it 38 ships? Is it 33 ships? And increasingly, the statements coming out from SecNav's office is we'll get by with 33 with increasing risk. And of course, you've heard that before. Increasing risk means increasing risk to the Marines. And they're aware of that. Now, Marines, when told to go ashore and fight, have never said no, and they're very aware of risk, and they've dealt with it in their entire history. So they'll probably, you know, put their chests out, press on, and do the best they can with the resources they have. But I see a significant struggle for the Marine Corps to get those resources that they need. That giant wad of money associated with post 9/11 GWAT and OEF OIF is, you know, as we all know, is just gone. So there's going to be a fight for that.
Speaking of programs under the gun, about in January of this year, you published an article in Proceedings called Fortress at Sea, the Carrier Invulnerability Myth. Could you talk a little bit about that and what that portends in your view for the Navy?
Well, I think that the threat has changed so much that the old look back to the Cold War and develop systems to deal with that is just something that we can't afford to do anymore, especially with the unclassified reports on the Chinese anti-ship ballistic missile. I mean, there are others that would argue that, you know, the threat is not 10 feet tall, and it's something that we can deal with, and that we can develop, you know, tactics and countermeasures just as we always have. I'm not so hopeful that that's the case, though. I think that a tectonic shift in the relevance of the aircraft carrier is underway. And again, my own humble opinion here, but when you take a look at the value of the carrier, it's not the carrier itself, of course, it's the carrier air wing. When you remove some of those inherent capabilities we've had in the past because we didn't have the threat there, like the ASW capability on the S-3, like the refueling capability of the S-3, I mean, you've even reduced that capability. We've gotten rid of our longer-range aircraft from the carriers. The A-6 is gone, real long legs, real good strike capability, and others. We're relying essentially now on a family of FA-18, CD, ENF. So the legs of the carrier air wing are much shorter than they used to be by several hundred miles, which means you've got to bring the carrier in close to the threat in order to make the air wing relevant, because it's got to get out to where it goes and come back, or you've got to have strategic strategic refueling aircraft in theater to support that. And in a scenario when you're talking about in the Western Pacific against a China-type adversary, it's just you just cannot assume that you'll have those tankers in there to support the carrier air wing going as far as they do, for example, right now. When a carrier air wing is supporting strike operations over Afghanistan, you're talking about a huge tanker requirement to get them there and get them back in very long missions. Those aircraft would be inherently threatened in a China-type scenario by very robust air defenses, both from the ground and from the Chinese Navy, that they would either be shot down or would be so threatened they would just wouldn't bring them in there at all. So you got to bring that carrier real up far, up close to the threat. And are we willing to do that? Carriers inherently don't have, as we all know, don't have a lot of defenses themselves. They rely on the strike group elements to defend them. But when you're talking about old Russian-style, multi-axis salvo cruise missile threats from both submarines, surface ships, and bombers, how well we can actually address that threat with the carrier strike group assets, I think, is changing. China and other adversaries are developing all kinds of new anti-ship cruise missiles, very long range. By the way, they outrange our Harpoon cruise missile, sometimes 2-to-1. So they can shoot these cruise missiles before our surface units can get in range to shoot them, so they have an inherent advantage there. The numbers are climbing. Fourth and fifth generation aircraft, they can put pretty far out. They're getting the strategic tanker capability, getting better all the time. I just don't think you're going to be able, in a Westpac scenario, you're going to be able to get a carrier close enough to make a difference. If the air wing is irrelevant, the carrier is irrelevant. So that's where I was going along with that article. My thesis, my premise in that article is, don't just assume that a carrier is invulnerable or a carrier in certain threat environments is even going to be relevant. We've got to do war games. We've got to look at a possible worst-case scenario when a smart adversary will develop a conventional or an asymmetric capability that will either marginalize or temporarily put a carrier out of the fight or even sink it. But my argument in the article was, you don't have to sink a carrier to take it out of the fight. I mean, if you make the carrier air wing irrelevant, in Sun Tzu's type view, you've eliminated. You don't have to sink it to make it irrelevant in that kind of scenario.
I think you hit right there on something that we've talked about in the past. Is decisions made 20 years ago, specifically in the aviation side of the house, have really painted the whole carrier concept in a corner. We've lost our deep strike capability. We've starved to death the unsexy things, such as tankers, to the point that we did what used to be a joke, which is one F-18 nipple feeding off another F-18, which, of course, now that F-18 can no longer be used to do strike. And we also saw this week an announcement put out that we're actually putting some money out, I believe it was DARPA, to research what has really been one of our little nasty secrets, not really secret at all, in the surface warfare world, is that what few anti-surface weapons that we carry are the Harpoon, which is multi-generations old, and the rest of the world has lapped us. I think the Japanese anti-ship cruise missile they're developing, they've realized that requirement is. So we're a little bit behind the curve there. I think if they do it smart, there's a way to do it. When you talk about the Westpac scenario and the tyranny of distance that's involved in there and the requirement to bring the carrier closer and closer, and you get that smaller area of probability, if we don't develop that anti-surface capability, how much of the air wing can even do it across the beach if they have to be concerned with that? Where do you see the Chinese emphasis on anti-surface warfare compared to our emphasis or lack of it in the last 15 years? And do you think we have a growing appreciation that area has been neglected?
Well, to answer the latter question first, I think that there is a clear appreciation by Navy thinkers, Navy strategists, and Navy leaders that they got to do something about this anti-ship cruise missile gap, if you want to call it that. The Chinese are leapfrogging. I mean, they're not just they're not just reverse engineering U.S. or Russian or other stuff nowadays. They're creating their inherently their own electronic capabilities and weapon systems that are just they're pretty good, as good as some of ours. So that's the challenge. Navy leaders are aware of that. I think that there's been some recent press that they're throwing some money into another look at developing a harpoon replacement. There's been talk about re-engineering the TLAMs to back into the anti-ship role. There is, of course, several versions of the harpoon that are out there that have been, ironically, the harp, and it is totally unclassified, it's out there. It's the version of the harpoon that we sold to allies is actually a better, more capable harpoon than the one we have on our surface.
Exactly.
Because this is the height of irony that would, but they're still producing these more current versions of the harpoon being sold to our foreign partners, and there's a couple other versions down the road that they've offered that the Navy just hasn't had the either the funds or the priority to buy. So I think there's options out there, but they're awful expensive. I put an article out about five months ago that just suggested, hey, look, I mean, we already got the harpoon higher end versions. Surely, and I'm no engineer expert on this, but my assumption is you can take the old airframes and the old components and at least reuse some of them. There's got to be some economic efficiencies we can derive there to keep that assembly line open and get new versions of the harpoon. The biggest shock that came to me when I looked at this was, and when I had some engineer friends that I asked, and I said, you got to be kidding me. And it's the VLS system that's the vertical launch system on most of our surface combatants is not compatible with the harpoon. And I said, who made that decision? So they're simply because essentially it's different defense firms that have developed the two systems, so they're not compatible. But there are things you can do to make them compatible. It does cost some money. So you could take those old quad launchers off the back of the ships, which are horrible radar eyesores. I mean, those things like radar like crazy. Get rid of those and develop a version of the harpoon that can be fired from the VLS. And the VLS, because it's bigger than the existing launchers, can actually take a larger version of the harpoon with a larger fuel tank, which gives it that extra range, or perhaps even a larger warhead, or maybe a couple different kinds of warheads. So there's options out there. Yeah, they're expensive, but when everybody has a missile that is essentially almost twice the range as ours, and potentially significantly better electronic capability, countermeasures, maneuver that I can't imagine how long we're going to be able to tolerate a condition like that. And surface warfare officers, they know it. I mean, you ask any of them, and they say, yeah, we got an obsolete missile. They can shoot before we can, and we may or may not be able to shoot the missile down when it's coming at us. I'm a little surprised that we let ourselves get into this kind of situation. China's developing new missiles all the time. They're not stupid. They know what our weaknesses are. I think that, sometimes it just comes down to, as I said before, sometimes it comes down to old Cold War Russian tactics, multi-axis salvo cruise missiles, many of which will be passive until just the absolute last minute when they turn on the active seeker, so you have very little warning, fired by bombers, long-range bombers, which, again, if you're not emitting your radar and you have some other way to find the target, we don't know they're out there, perhaps until they're real close. Combined with submarine launches, which you don't know a submarine's launching a cruise missile until that thing pops out of the water. If you don't have a good handle on tracking the submarine itself, and I think all of us know the state of play with USASW at sea as well. That's another, just like doing away with our tanker capability and our real robust anti-submarine capability on the carriers. It's going to be a while before we get that capability back to where we used to be on the surf on our surface combatants as well. It's just that since the threat's not there, we haven't been practicing it. So it's a tough one, and I hope the Navy puts the money into it that's needed. But, yeah, that's a big challenge for us.
Yeah, I've always thought people say, well, that's old Cold War. And, yeah, it is. It was effective. Having an infantryman with a rifle is also pretty old-school technology, but that's pretty damn effective, too, for its primary mission. And I also think that the cost argument you hear a lot of people, especially when you talk about anti-surface warfare kind of dying on the vine, but as that great philosopher Rumsfeld once said, you go to war with the army or put navy that you have here, and few things are more expensive, either from a strategic risk point of view in the macro or the micro of a ship, than having somebody sunk because you weren't able to engage a potential target. Eagle One, I stole your time.
That's all right. It seems to me that we've kind of lost the initiative in sea denial, that we've just given up the or we're asleep for 20 years or something, and that we've kind of exceeded the idea that there's going to be a 25 or 30 mile offshore area that the major Navy isn't planning really to go and play in. And I know you've written some stuff on the LCS. I know you had an article in the Armed Forces Journal about that, but wasn't that intended to kind of cover that 25-mile, 30-mile gap between where the big ships were and the beach, and help bust through the C-301s and all those other missiles that could be fired off the beach?
Indeed, that was the intent, but regrettably, and all the maritime threat experts that I talk with about the LCS, we all agree, you know, the one main point is that the LCS essentially cannot defend itself. So when you're talking about putting that ship in a high-threat environment, the Navy for the longest time said that speed would be the greatest capability of that ship and get it out of harm's way. But I have yet to see, I'm not a physicist, but, you know, 50 knots, you know, is not going to outrun, a Mach 2 plus capable cruise missile. We just, speed is not necessarily an answer. It's a problem. It can't defend itself. By the way, the missile system that was supposed to go on the LCS, the NLOS, non-line of sight missile, was canceled about 8 months ago by the Navy. So it's not going to have a short or even medium range anti-ship capability with that missile. So it's got essentially a very small gun. It's got, and then whatever those modules that come with it to support it, the surface module, mining module, and the anti-submarine module. But it inherently has no ability to defend itself except outside a very, very short range with the SeaWiz and a pretty small caliber gun. So I just don't know where we're going with that. And with them being so expensive, if you are going to try to layer that into the literal area then and protect the other shipping, you need a lot of them. And right now, the way we're going, we're not going to have very many of them. I think we've made a grave mistake with that. I mean, we're trying to get Cadillacs when we should have Novas. And, you know, Jerry Hendricks has argued this in a couple articles as well. The FIG-7 was such a successful platform, still is in my mind, even though it's been castrated with the removal of the surface-to-air missile. And the harpoon, by the way, when you remove that forward launcher from the FIG-7, you've taken away not just its air defense capability, but you've taken away its anti-surface capability with the harpoon missile, which is, you know, the ship's a eunuch now, as far as I'm concerned. But it's the reason why it was so successful was because it was small, it was very simple, it was, you know, when I say single mission ship, it had a couple different capabilities and different missions, but it was largely a single mission ship. It was a lower-end ship designed to protect itself real well, but also do that convoy escort, lower-end maritime security missions, MEO, things like that, ideal. And then the robust flight capability SH-60s. You don't have that kind of capability on the LCS. It almost makes more sense to just build more FIG-7s because, you know, we've already got a design. We've got a production line. Yeah, granted, it's been cold for a while, but they're still very capable ships. That the Australians have just revamped their class of FIG-7s and put VLS on the forward part of the ship, which has given it an entirely new capability. So I think they're still viable. I mean, in my view, that is the easy answer. Yeah, it can't go as shallow as the LCS presumably can. It isn't anywhere near as fast as the LCS. But it's a good all-around, you know, capable, robust, single-mission ship that can take care of business. When you try to strap too much stuff onto the LCS, it just becomes, number one, too expensive, number two, too complex, because you got that inherent cadre crew that's got to be able to conduct, you know, battle management and combat systems with all three of those different kinds of modules, anti-surface, mining, and anti-submarine. Very challenging. You know, if you have a single mission focus on a ship that the crew trains to and that your combat system suite is geared towards, so much simpler. You know, I would have loved to qualify surface warfare on a Fig 7 because it had a little bit of everything, not too complex to be overwhelming, and it didn't have so many combat systems strapped onto it that it became inviable for the actual weight. By the way, that's a recent story on that on the LCS. The actual weight of all the systems they strapped up on the top of the LCS has now caused serious stability problems. They've got to actually add a couple new tanks, low tanks, to give the ship basic stability in heavy seas because they strap so much crap onto it. So we've taken what's supposed to be the old Street Fighter concept to get in there and get in the mix in the literal environment, take on the diesel subs, take on the coastal defense cruise missiles, and take on those swarming small craft. And essentially, it cannot handle that. The array of threats that we're going to see in that kind of anti-access, sea denial environment that you're talking about. So I'm sort of probably taking longer than I need to, but with the question. But I'm pretty passionate about the LCS being the wrong ship at the wrong time.
Now you'll never get an objection from this corner. We've been screaming about the LCS literally for years over at my home blog, and it's been very frustrating for me to watch because the concerns that many people came out with early on about this and basically were professionally told to sit down and shut up have all come to fruition, whether you're talking about the costs, whether you're talking about the complete PowerPoint thin manning concept, and everything that comes to that, whether you're talking about damage control, habitability, etc., its survivability, or the whole mission module concept. And we even have one of our regular commenters who's a ship fitter, and he came out 3 years ago and brought up exactly the point that you said. Wait a minute, the minute you bring all this stuff on, especially when you're talking about LCS-1 type, you're center of gravity is going to be way too high for your moment arm, and the thing is never going to come up on plane, especially when you have to add berthing for an extra 25 people, which you'll have to do. All that's come to be, and what we saw in the last couple of weeks, at least the way that I do it, what I call it, is we've punted. We were supposed to come to down select, but instead we said, no, we're just going to build two. And it almost seems as if, and tell me what you see from your side here, that as an institution, as we've cut steel and put these things at sea, we've all of a sudden realized that, my God, you can't make this work, the laws of physics being what they are. And we've panicked because we've already decided we're not going to do more Fig 7s. Or my option would always be, we admit our error, let's license build a Nansen or an Absalon class for run a 12 to 24 until we can get it decently domestically designed multi-purpose frigate-sized ship. But kicking it down, the down select even more, how much further do we have to go until somebody has a come-to-Jesus meeting? Because I haven't seen anything that tells me that this weapons concept is going to be anything but an unmitigated disaster.
Yep, I couldn't agree with you more. I got an article that will come out in January proceedings that essentially it's essentially when are they going to shoot the flare on this thing, shoot the red flare and say, we're in trouble here. Anyway, I don't have total insights into the PEO shop or the Navy leader decisions, et cetera, but I see little indicators in some of the stories coming out in Defense News, et cetera, that the Navy leadership is realizing that they're in a bad spot based on essentially a decade of potentially a bad decisions. So I'll be curious to see over the next year that happens, because there was a story about 2 weeks ago that says, hey, we're just, we're considering buying both, as you just said. And immediately you had a firestorm of criticism. And just recently, I think 3 days ago, there was an article that said, maybe we won't buy both. As soon as I saw that, I threw my arms up in the air because I said, now you're taking all that complexity of mission modules and training and systems compatibility and just the costs themselves of these modules. Now you've got to have compatibility issues for two different ship, essentially two subclasses. So you've got to have two different training pipelines. They have different combat system suites and sensors that folks have to train to, that you've got to develop a maintenance package for, from just periodic maintenance to depot level. You're talking about extreme inefficiencies with essentially taking a class of ships and turning it into two subclasses. I just can't understand how that could be viable. And I'll be curious to see how the Navy answers that question in the next several weeks as this story pans out. my guess is that the Congressional Research Service folks will quickly put out a product that says, you know, essentially that says, you got to be kidding me. I can't believe you're thinking about doing this, Navy. So that my suspicion is Ronald O'Rourke is already writing something like that. Yeah, so it just defies logic that we would attempt to buy both of them. I just don't understand it. I think it's going to increase the cost. It's going to reduce efficiencies big time. There's a lot of surface warriors out there right now that are saying, what the heck? And I'm not sure where we're going with this. So it's going to be an interesting time ahead. I just think that the bottom line is going to be the dollars, and somebody's going to say, I'll stop. We can't do this.
Well, speaking of dollars, I want to slightly shift to a different area, which has to do with the use of multi-billion-dollar cruisers and guided missile destroyers to go chase nickel and dime pirates off Somalia. Where are the vessels we should really be using to pursue that sort of threat to commerce on the highways of the sea? Have you got a feel for that?
Well, I've argued in a couple different articles that, you know, my byline is send the warships home. They got more important things to do. Not home, meaning to home port, but send them back to the combatant commander and say, hey, you know, all those warships you're screaming for, here, you can have them back and just turn off the anti-piracy mission. Because, you know, once you're dealing with out at sea in international waters, you know, you're dealing with the symptoms, and you can spin your wheels all day and not address the root cause of the problem. I've argued that the best vessels to be used for that kind of operation is close into the coast, essentially law enforcement vessels, which for our purposes, for the U.S. side, means Coast Guard cutters. Close in, law enforcement capable, as well as some you know, lower-end surface capability with their guns, et cetera, and the helicopters. If it is, in fact, criminal activity, which it is, and it's not associated with terrorism, et cetera, then you need to stop the activity ashore, or at least stop it from getting outside of those territorial waters to become an international problem. Because, the big merchants and the commerce in the area isn't coming anywhere near the territorial waters. So if you can contain it, and admittedly you would need a lot of hulls to do this, you could do it with a law enforcement force. Now, you would need some sort of international cover, perhaps a United Nations mandate that provided for a multinational law enforcement capability to go do that. It would only be viable for as long as you actually had the ships there doing it. There are most of the global law enforcement, you know, regulatory Coast Guard type forces are already overtaxed, including our own. So I'm not sure how many nations would be able to actually, you know, belly up to the bar and provide the resources. So that's a problem with that. But as we saw from the piracy conference that the Naval Institute held a few weeks ago, you know, the threat, the Maersk discussion was awesome. The speaker said essentially that from the U.S. perspective, the impact of piracy on commerce is nil. It's not even worth paying any attention at all. Yet we have, from your first line of questioning there, we have 25-plus warships out there from various countries, at any one time usually 5 or 6 U.S. warships, high-end warships, DDGs, you know, Burke class designed for very high-end warfighting capabilities, you know, spinning their screws, escorting ships, and there is a lot more important things that they could be doing in the Persian Gulf or elsewhere around the globe. Not necessarily an easy problem to fix, but if you transition that force from a gray hull to a white hull capable force closer into the coast, law enforcement, you know, capable force as well, so that when they actually do capture the pirates, there's something that you actually can do. If it's not going to be a shooting match and they're going to give up, then perhaps there's some gathering of evidence, maybe some biometrics to get a baseline of identities for who the players are and if they're repeat offenders, things like that. The problem with that, even after all that is said and done, though, is where do you bring the pirates to prosecute them, to jail them? Because even today we're seeing Kenya, which has stepped up to the plate in the past couple of years, is now saying we're overwhelmed, we can't do it anymore, we're not going to take any more pirates. And when they brought the pirates from the last major incident with a U.S. ship all the way back to the U.S. for prosecution, they're bouncing around between appeals now because they can't necessarily agree that the incidents with the U.S. frigates and others were acts of piracy, because the definition under the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea on piracy is very specific, that there has to be a theft and there has to be a boarding of a ship and some sort of theft that occurs. And because that didn't occur with that attack that occurred, I wouldn't call it an attack. They popped a few rounds off and shot at one of the Navy ships, and the Navy ships returned fire, destroyed the ship, killed a few pirates, and then took some into custody. They're having trouble figuring out what the actual charge is against these guys, and the piracy charge didn't hold up in court. So not an easy problem, but after all that trouble, having gone to all that means to get them back for prosecution, and now that effort is floundering, my view is, okay, we got better things to do. Let's just, you know, either do it right or don't do it, in my view.
Yeah, sticking to piracy for a little bit, but before I get to that, yeah, Eagle One, you got a follow-on?
Well, I was going to say that the district courts in Norfolk have split now. One court has said, yeah, they can be tried for piracy, and the other court has said, no, they can't, and it really gets down to an interpretation of an old decision by Justice Story back from, I don't know, 1825 or something. So not to get too far down in the weeds on that, but it is an interesting question from a legal point of view, and it is up in the air right now, but I assume that the Fourth Circuit eventually is going to have to resolve that.
Yeah, now there's some countries out there that take a whole different view on how you deal with pirates when you capture them. And I'm not saying we need to go down that road, and we need to get the moral high ground as the U.S. and follow, you know, precedent in international law, et cetera. But there's been a handful of piracy incidents that, you know, those pirates are never seen again.
Are you talking about the Russian model, I assume?
Yeah. So, you know, should we be doing that or not? I'm not necessarily saying we should be, committing unlawful acts at sea, et cetera. But, what we're doing right now is does not result in any kind of deterrence against the pirates of coming out and doing it all over again. So why don't we just pack it up and move on if we're not going to have that law enforcement capability close to the ship?
Well, for a lot of the pirates, there's no downside. If they get captured and they get sent to Sweden or Denmark or someplace, you know, they can go to jail for a while. That's probably better than their life in Somalia. And then they get to apply for some kind of sanctuary in a modern European country. And so that's the worst side. If you get captured, if you don't get captured and you take a ship, you become a very wealthy man in Somali society. It's a difficult problem.
If I could bring up a couple things that we heard at the piracy conference, just to see if we can get you to flesh it out, because you were a very good panel lead in the fact you let the other members of the panel speak a lot to it. But I think kind of what we were talking about just a minute ago is when you look at the U.S. experience of trying pirates, and the Dutch have tried it too, the whole Kenyan thing has become a dog's breakfast. Assume that trend line on trying people goes to its logical conclusion from here. There are a couple other things that can come up, one of which I think, you know, you're talking about going from gray hole to white hole and coming closer. That would be to focus on those primary ports or areas of Somalia. I think port is a little bit of an exaggeration on what some of these places are, to not do an embargo on them, but to put a close hold on it. But there's also something I'm a fan of. I'm not quite as far as somebody like the commenter John Derbyshire is, but I'm a believer in punitive expeditions when there are no other good options. That is, identifying the major players and the major material support, bring it ashore, and then leave. Do you see that combination? I know our allies aren't going to have the appetite before, except for maybe the Russians, but going towards bringing the solution or the mitigation ashore, are we going to be stuck at sea?
I don't think we have any choice. I think we're stuck at sea. Somalia is, you know, denied area for DOD. We're not allowed to operate ashore. We don't have, you know, as we all know, there's no viable government, no viable police or military. So without massive state-building effort, which, you know, again, huge dollar sign associated with that, which nobody wants to touch with a 10-foot pole, especially the U.S. after the, you know, Black Hawk Down syndrome, you know, we're like not, you know, we're not spending another dollar or risking another U.S. soldier for the Somalis. It's just not going to happen. So I think we're stuck with, from the waterline outward on dealing with the problem. You could, you know, we have every capability in the world to conduct punitive missions ashore. Marine Corps, you know, if you put a Mew out there, I mean, they would take care of business very rapidly. But it might only be a temporary effect. And at the end of the day, I think that my guess is that the policymakers take a look at all the options on the table and they say there is some risk in direct punitive missions in achieving a positive policy outcome. And if there is significant risk of collateral damage or bad media or otherwise, when the alternative is nil as far as the impact on U.S. commerce, you know, I think prudence is you know, the rule right now is prudence to say that just is not worth our while because of the risk of a very serious, maybe not, you know, critical, but a serious negative policy outcome. And even if we get one Marine killed in a process, you know, was that worth it? I don't know. It's a tough one. But right now, I think it's just unpalatable.
Eagle One?
Well, speaking of issues involving public perception, someone asked earlier, I'm trying to track it down, so I was a little slow here, about gunfire, naval gunfire ashore. Is that a concept that we seem to have lost because it's either not accurate enough or we're worried about some kind of publicity if we blow up the wrong thing? Are we just out of that business?
To a degree, yes. I wrote a couple articles for Marine Corps Gazette. I'm pretty passionate about that one, too. Being an old amphib sailor, helping the Marines get to the beach, you know, and they're willing to do, you know, whatever the national, you know, command authorities tells them to do at any risk. But we have absolutely come up short with supporting the Marine Corps with a viable naval surface fire support capability. You know, battleships are long gone. They're not coming back. We need to deal with that. You know, but if we're having a doctrine, as was spoken earlier here, of supporting the Marines but doing it from 25 miles from the beach, it's not viable. Our longest-range gun system on our surface combatants is roughly 13 nautical miles. So, you know, do the math, and it comes up well short of the beach. So one option is, which actually I'm very happy to see has been thrown around in the past few months, is Marine Corps seems to be, from Quantico, from McCitic, thrown back on the table to the Navy. If you're not going to develop a new viable naval surface warfare, naval surface fire support capability, then you got to come closer to the beach. You know, you got to come 5 nautical miles, 10 nautical miles, put your gray hulls at higher risk because, hell, we're putting Marines at higher risk every day when they conduct their operations, to be able to at least make those 5-inch guns more viable for naval surface fire support. And in fairness to the Navy, there's been some pretty respectable developments along the lines of rocket-assisted munitions. There's a new version of the 5-inch gun that's being put on most of the ships, the 5-inch 62 instead of the 5-inch 54 caliber. So you essentially have an inherently better gun, longer range capability even without the rocket assist. Very expensive rounds, though. When you're talking about a rocket assist, GPS-guided munition, you're talking about tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars for one round, which, you know, one round, one hit is great in theory with a GPS-guided weapon, but super, super expensive. You know, the Excalibur round, which is the 155-millimeter round that the Marine Corps and Army now use on their lightweight 155-millimeter howitzer, which is a superb weapon, very light, made of titanium, can be carried by the Osprey and the 53, is a fantastic weapon, but the round cost $100,000. So how viable is that? You know, how many of those can you buy before you run out of money? So the Navy hasn't reached necessarily an end point with what they're going to do with that. A lot of folks will point to the TLAM, to the Tomahawk missile, as a viable naval surface fire support capability for the Marine Corps. Yeah, it's out there, and it's out there in pretty good numbers, but the timeliness is what is the issue with that one. I mean, we all know that this, you know, the TLAM is essentially looked at as a combatant command weapon. You know, it's designed for contingencies. It's very long range. It's very expensive, and the timeliness just isn't there. Marines need high volume area fires. Say, for example, you got a column of 100 you know, soft skinned and armored personnel carriers of the adversary. You know, you need multiple TLAMs to take care of that, unless you're talking about the submunition round. So, is, you know, that very expensive missile for, you know, essentially a 1,000-pound warhead. Navy will also say that we'll time out. We've got TAC air. We've got, you know, strike air from the carrier to take care of the Marine Corps requirements. And the Marine Corps will respond back with, yes, you do, but when the weather goes to hell and you can't launch the aircraft or you can't acquire the targets from altitude, then, you know, it's useless because, you know, the laser-guided weapons, you need to clear a line of sight with no obscurance to get good guidance from the drop until it hits the aim point. And with GPS weapons, you need to be able to figure out what you're looking at and then derive a GPS coordinate and then plug it into the weapon, which takes time. And we all know what happens when you put the wrong coordinate into a into a 2,000-pound weapon, I mean, then you got a CNN story on your hands when you've hit the wrong target and killed, you know, 30, 40 civilians. Navy has not provided viable naval surface fire support in a way that can be timely for the Marines, in a way that provides enough volume, heavy volume fires, you know, consistent amount. You know, the warhead size of a 5-inch round is very tiny, too. It's just you're talking about between 5 and 10 pounds of explosive. That's just not very much. That's just, so you can't do a whole lot of damage one of those rounds. You could do a lot of damage with 100 of those rounds, but you need, you imagine the number of, for example, Arleigh Burkes you would need in the area to conduct that kind of capability. And with three DDG-1000s, which will have the new advanced gun system, AGS, if they can ever make it work, and if it falls within the cost constraints they have right now, there is that is a better weapon. It's essentially a 155-millimeter round. It's got longer range. It's very expensive, too, but they have some new capabilities that they can lob rounds pretty quickly and saturate an area pretty well. A little bit higher explosive charge on the round because it's 155-millimeter. But that's down the road, and imagine three ships. You got global contingencies around the world that would need naval surface fire support, and you don't need it, 3 months from now. You need it tomorrow. So I don't. Even the Marines sort of shrug and say, "How is three ships going to meet our naval surface fire support answers?"
And as we know, it really takes three ships to make one. You got one deployed, you've got one getting repairs or some shipyard availability time, and another one in workup. So it's the whole thing. And I think you outlined really well. It's really kind of a heartbreak. You don't have to be a Marine to see it because it's not something that. Way in the past. There's a reason why every British warship built since the Falkland Wars has to have a gun. You read Woodward's 100 Days, they talk about they basically just shot the liner off their 4.5-inch guns. Incredibly important. You had the, what I call 5-inch Friday during the invasion of Iraq. You can talk about up close and personal where we had, led by the Australian ANZAC, you had those ships go right up next to the All-File Peninsula and do the Lord's work there for the Marines and the British during the invasion. But you also touched on something earlier that we talk about urban warfare. And the Israeli action a little over a year ago in Gaza, they actually had a lot of their ships using precision fires from the sea to near-shore targets. Very, very, very precise attacks that you just simply couldn't do from the air. And I just haven't seen that sold more, but I think that's a real viable option. And kind of going from there, but it kind of folds into it. The question I wanted to throw at you here is the last decade, call it from 2000 to 2010, the lost decade, if you look at the major programs we have, it's LPD-17, it's LCS, and it's DDG-1000. They're all three very troubled programs. Do you see a common set of problems? And I'm not talking about engineering problems. I'm talking human problems of leadership, vision, and program management that we can kind of tie all those programs together that we've been doing wrong. And what could we do to not repeat the mistakes we made in the fat years? Because obviously there's got to be some common thread that combines those three problem programs together.
I don't know. The two mistakes I think we've done, it's not any one person or any one office, but the trend seems to be, number one, we've assumed away the threat because we had essentially a decade where we sort of scratched our heads and said, the threat's gone. What is going to be the next threat? And no one really... In fairness, and in the intel business as well, no one necessarily provided a real clear framework of the next generation of threats to give these the acquisition folks guidance on what they'd be looking at. And even if you look at the anti-access, anti-denial threat, the diesel subs, the CDCMs, and the swarm, you're talking about low tech. You're not talking about any kind of new fifth generation capability that we're dealing with. We're talking about just a large volume of stuff that's been around for decades. So I would say that we've assumed away the threat that we just wouldn't have to deal with it. And as a result, I think there was a tendency to accept fewer numbers of much more highly capable ships because the whole 90s, everybody was drinking the Kool-Aid about technology as a panacea, that with these precision weapons, with no one able to touch our level of technology, that you don't need 100 frigates to take care of an issue. Maybe you just need two or three Berks because of the precision weapons, because they're much more capable. You don't need 15 sorties of aircraft to take out a target. You need, real capable TAC air, one aircraft could take out, 15 targets in some cases. So it's just the reverse. LCS is a good example of it with the smaller crew, optimal crew manning, which is sort of ironic because it's suboptimal all around. So technology will take care of everything. We don't need the people to do it. And we're finding day after day that what you need is almost double the crew that you have on the LCS to take care of even basic things like MEO, like a boarding team. You essentially have no people for a boarding team, so you don't need to bring another berthing compartment on and bring 20 people on to form that capability if you're going to be doing a robust maritime security with boarding teams. So between the two of those two trends, and that is fewer but much more capable, highly sophisticated platforms to take care of the threat, and, well, there's not going to be much of a threat anyway, so even if we don't, quantity has, we've all heard that quantity has a quality all its own, but we have made that mistake, and we've put all of our eggs into golden baskets. Have we learned? And the other part of your question, and what's the next step for us down the road? My sense is hearing folks from PEO and industry talk about it is there is a realization that mistakes were made and that they've got to change it. But every congressman wants that high-end ship built in his district, and money seems to rule the day as always. And I'm not sure that we've turned the corner back to, a realization that, number one, we're not going to always have the most robust Navy in the world. In that, number two, we're not going to always have the most sophisticated, latest weapon system to take care of business. I think we're going to have to, you've heard the acceptance of a sort of a appetite suppressant for our capability. I think everybody's going to have to deal with that, whether we like it or not, because of money. We probably need to revert back to a acquisition effort that is essentially accepting a lower capable system and more of them. I think we're going to get back to the era of quantity again. Quantity with, as much high tech as you need, but, I've always argued that we need more single mission ships. And if you keep a mission ship simple, if you make, it used to be that cruisers were largely anti-air and that destroyers were sub-hunters and that frigates were essentially, lower-end missions, convoy escort and sort of ash trash missions. Now we're trying to make ships do everything, and they're so expensive they're just not viable. I think we need to get back to not necessarily the high-low mix, but maybe the low-low mix. A lot of less capable ships that are a lot less expensive, a lot less complex, that are actually manageable to do what we need to do.
Well, speaking of things we need to do, I was going to ask you from your strategic intelligence point of view, the Coast Guard now is, at least one admiral from the Coast Guard has called for more icebreakers. What's your view of what's happening up in the Arctic with the seeming decreasing amount of ice up there?
Well, by full disclosure, I'm no expert on that. But the research I've done for a couple articles, suggests that, it's not necessarily a national security crisis. We don't have to drop everything and put that at the top of the heap of national security priorities. But it is something we're going to have to deal with. And now that we have, the foresight and the prudence and the decade or so ahead of us to try to take some action, we should be doing that now. The old commandant, Coast Guard, said, we're not really going to try to do that. That's too much. Now, we saw a refreshing new change with the new commandant, a suggestion that, let's take another look at that because we're going to have some viable capability. When things go south in the Arctic, it's over the next decade, it's not going to be, a anti-ship cruise missile fight. It's going to be a cruise ship or a merchant that's sinking or in distress or et cetera. And so the Coast Guard, of course, they're going to turn to the Coast Guard and say, send in the guardsmen. Where are they? I think there's a realization they're going to have the capability for search and rescue, obviously, number one. But on top of all that, before you go search and rescue anybody, you need to know what's out there. I famously went to a brief done by the Canadians on the maritime domain awareness in the Arctic, and they put a white, pure white slide up, and they said, here's our maritime domain awareness of the Arctic. I mean, they don't know where anything is. There was no sensors looking at the area. It's, you know, it's just vast white sheet of ice, and largely, you know, unpopulated and no ships anyway. But, you know, the first thing you need to do before you is figure out what's there. So we're going to have some national architecture to be able to use the technology we have to figure out who's out there when, so they can at least, we can, number one, identify them, and number two, track them, so if there is some kind of problem. But it looks like the Coast Guard is asking for more money to push back into the polar class, the two polar class icebreakers, very capable ships. I mean, if you've ever looked at their, you know, the diagram and their capability list, they're just fabulous ships all around, wonderful ships, but they're very expensive to maintain. And we haven't done a good job of that because of other priorities. I don't think we have a choice. I think we're going to have at least two very capable polar class. You know, Russia has at least five, maybe more, huge nuclear-powered icebreakers, and we have none. So that's another option that's down the road. And, you know, because you need to have that constant, reliable power generation, and you're going to have very, very long missions in the middle of nowhere with essentially no logistics support, not just limited, but none in the Arctic. You know, that's where that nuclear power plant makes it all of a sudden very viable. I think we're going to have to look at that. I'm frankly a little surprised that no one's talked about that. My guess is just, again, it's the dollar sign associated with, you know, a nuclear power plant associated with that class. But, you know, U.S. is no, we're not newcomers to the nuclear propulsion field. You know, submarines, carriers are all nuclear powered. So I don't see why that would be so daunting, frankly. Even yesterday, two days ago, I saw the CNO make a very surprising statement. He said, forgive me if it wasn't the CNO, I may have my facts a little bit backwards, a very senior Navy guy, maybe it was Fleet Forces Command, Admiral Harvey, who said, we have got to relook the way we're looking at ships, and we're going to have some very limited ice-breaking capability in the Navy. Now, I don't know if he said ice-breaking. I think he said ice-hardened hulls.
Right.
So I'm hoping that those preceding articles that we did 6 months, 8 months, a year ago have got some traction, because if the national security or defense mission exceeds Coast Guard capabilities or actually becomes some kind of shooting situation in the Arctic, we got to do something. You know, you can't fight a war from the air with a P-3 or a C-130J. You got to get a ship up there, or at least as far as you can up there. So, and admittedly, he didn't necessarily say we'd be making Navy icebreakers, but he said we got to have the CONOPS, we've got to have the procedures to be able to deal with ice up on the main deck to make the ship still viable, the ventilation systems, the engineering, so that we can deal with these, you know, sub-zero temperatures on ships. But my guess is, I mean, if you've looked at how thick the hull is on ships these days, you might be really shocked to see how thin they are. So I'd be curious to see what happens. I think there's been a realization that there'll be largely homeland security issues for Coast Guard, but that we've got to be able to back the Coast Guard up if things go south.
Absolutely, and I think if you talk to one of our commenters, Byron, he said after a few years they get even thinner. Well, I'll tell you what, John, that's, again, the quickest hour in maritime security. Mid-Rats, thank you very much for taking time out of Sunday to come and talk about some of these issues. We could have easily gone another hour. I know in the chat room, Ken was fussing again. He wants us to go 90 minutes, but I don't think my wife would like that too much. Hey, if people wanted to read some of the work that you've done, where could they go, and what are some articles? You touched on a couple of them that you have coming up soon that people can look for.
I just say, especially if they're members of the Naval Institute, if you just put in the search block, just put, you know, my name in there, and you'll come up with these articles. They're largely focused on some of the things we talked about, the Arctic, the LCS, carrier viability, Navy surface fire support, the sea basing, another one that maybe we could talk about some other time, because there seems to be, no pun intended, seems to be a sea change in the Marine Corps about sea basing as well. That might be a topic for a later day. But that's the best way to do it. Most of the way the Naval Institute works is if you're not a member, you can't get to a lot of the articles. The Naval Institute is a fantastic organization, as I'm sure both of you would agree with. Pretty limited, very low cost to become a member, but that's the best way to do that. And I would encourage all the readers, too, to make the jump from the blog to the written article. A lot of these good ideas and robust discussion on the blogs can very easily be transitioned to articles that the Naval Institute would love to print.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And I want to invite everybody to come and join us again next week. We're going to have our second edition of NCO Leadership. We're going to have three mid-level NCOs on, including a fellow USNI blogger, YN2. He will be coming back and give us a report after his year in Afghanistan. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a great Navy Day.
Right, thank you, John, for being with us. Thank you for being with us.
Strand and Piccadilly for you.